But yeah, hello. Okay. Sorry. Let's say disruption is the predominant experience we're all having right now. If there's one American writer who can speak from a history of disruption, not as buzzword, but as actual textual practice, I think that writer is Bob Perlman. Perlman has a long history of addressing the breach between poetry's oral roots as an adjunct to memory whose social role was the confirmation of a governing order, and writing's multifarious ability to upend expectation and dispute the innumerable micro-hegemonies that nest throughout the nooks and crannies of language. Perlman can be trenchant, sardonic, satirical, theoretical. Coming up while the wounds of modernism were still bleeding across American poetry, he embarked on a project that questioned the avant-garde legacies that made his own work possible. In regard to Ezra Pound, for instance, he has written, "What gives the best of Pound's writing its power cannot be dissociated from the worst of it." The task then, at least in part, is to critically reorient that power. If Perlman is especially associated with the legacies of Pound, Stein, Zukofsky, and Joyce, the subjects of his landmark critical work, The Trouble with Genius, from which the quote I just read is taken, it is maybe equally important to consider his output through the lenses provided by Russian formalism, especially Viktor Shklovsky, whose technique of ostranenie, or defamiliarization, seems a keystone of Perlman's poetic practice, emphasizing a shift away from a politics of glorified recognition and towards one of productive uncertainty, a vital embrace of not knowing, a vital embrace of the not knowing that heralds all revolutionary novelty. Few poetry book titles feel as resonant right now as that of Perlman's 1988 collection, Captive Audience. In the poem Movie, where Ollie North moonlights as Oliver Hardy and Celine wanders a ghostly resurrected Bastille confronting his own anti-Semitism, Perlman notes, "Tears are running down the clown's face in the painting above the motel TV, but framing will get you nowhere outside the frame." Later in the same poem, he moves beyond a burlesque of T.S. Eliot to avow that good poets steal, bad ones watch TV, tears smearing their white face as they display the verbal, equivalent of scars and apply for grants 5 months late each time. Perlman is a linchpin of West Coast language poetry, editing the journal Hills and curating the San Francisco Talk series, which featured writers including Alan Davies, Carla Harriman, Lynn Hagenian, and many others. Besides his critical work, he's the author of more than 10 poetry collections, including Primer, aka Berkeley, The Future of Memory, and If Life. Perlman's newest book, Jack and Jill in Troy, out now from Roof Books, and you can order it from SPD, who incidentally could extremely much use your support and are great and do it, order it, get it, you need it, get it. That was a long parenthesis. Perlman's new book, Jack and Jill and Troy, out now from Roof Books, dwells among some of Perlman's oldest concerns as a writer and thinker. It is nearly 50 years since Perlman wrote of the Monday morning emperor whose pleasures so much poetry justifies, as the Aeneid justified the pleasures of the elite classes of ancient Rome. The book, in mostly breezy diction and relaxed, dare I say, Californian good humor, joyously exploits the ways in which our restless and ever-changing past incessantly bumps up against the present, as when Zeus savors the smoke of perfectly spiced BBQ. I won't quote his all-purpose disaster poem now, in part because I'm hoping he'll favor us with it in his reading, but suffice it to say, we are in a disaster and the poem works its purpose. In Aphrodite Never Old, he writes, "Love of what you are is everything, and love of what you're not is such a stretch that we're hard-pressed to escape the taint of the ridiculous, and we have to recognize the power in force, not that we have any choice." In an interview 25 years ago that perhaps now reveals how little has changed in the tenor of national affairs, Perlman noted, "The line between entertainment and politics is hard to draw these days. Politics, as we know it, has this bizarre entertainment aspect. We rate a politician's speeches on how well they play, not what they say. It's a performance. But we're a long way from making poetry a mass art. I come from an avant-garde that reads Stein and Williams and tries to do new things formally with poetry, but I'm also interested in what people who haven't read all this stuff hear in poetry. Rhetoric concerns the present. Can you hear what I'm saying right now? And what do you make of it? I'm interested in the political, ethical, aesthetic issues raised by bigger audiences." A few ellipses in there, by the way. As the potential audience for poetry readings grows bigger than it's ever been, generating all kinds of good and bad possibilities, and as the Monday morning emperors writhe in a desperation to retain their thrones despite the tidal wave of dissensus approaching their maritime borders, and as poetry in its form as a cybernetic apparition takes its place alongside orality and grammatology as a fully fledged form, can we hear what Bob Perlman is saying right now? I hope so, and I hope you will give him an extremely warm welcome. From sunny California, people, please go all the way crazy. You can go like this and he'll see it for Bob Perlman.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. Yeah, that was, God, I, you know, where's that interview from, may I ask? I don't remember that.
I'll send you a link. I have it.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I'm going to read for about 20 minutes from Jack and Jill and Troy with Francie Shaw's fantastic cover. I'll start here and let me just get my clock and all that. Okay. There's gonna be some Iliad makeovers, little kind of versions of bits from the Iliad. I think I'm just going to read them and maybe I'll say a few things afterwards, but I what worried me as I was writing this book, I was quite enjoying it and all that, but I was always worried that I was being too scholarly and you need footnotes and, you know, go check this and then read that and then you can read my poem. So I was really trying hard. I really do try hard to make it available at the moment to who's ever reading it, no matter what they've read before. Anyway, so I might sort of slip in a little bit of background after a poem or something. Okay, but now just to read a little bit. The opening poem is Classic Sunrise. Red-nosed dawn arose, but it had been worth it. All those gulps and gasps had made the edges of her eyes so sharp that now, when she finally did heave herself up out of the tossing sea, barely into the eggshell sky, temples throbbing, that goes without saying, without saying, without saying, she could see all that was not her, see the immortal not self perfectly as in a spotless mirror. So that poem was born of a sort of 14-year-old, kind of 14-year-old's pun of rosy-fingered dawn and red-nosed dawn. And this, I will say, the first talk I gave almost many decades ago, I got called out for not being... It was about Homer and oral poetics, and I got called out for not being respectful enough to Homer. So that's where it starts. The armor swap. The older poet red in neck and face. You can't talk about Homer that way. It's history, like his head was going to explode. When, in fact, writing an insulting but abortive challenge, from Diomedes the Greek to Glaucon the Trojan, as they come together in battle, Diomedes trolling, "Excuse me, but have we met? I'm more or less notorious in front of Troy. You might say I've spent serious time in the hot spots, but I don't think I've ever seen you before." Glaucon, though, doesn't bite. He sidesteps, musing about trees, so leafy one minute, bare branches the next, and we're each one leaf. And since you say we haven't met, here's my entire ancestry, which takes a while. But eventually it turns out that the ancestors of empathetic biothinker Glaucon and the ancestors of sneering warrior Diomedes were, way back, genuine allies. And this new aspect to the situation so enthuses Dee that he stabs his spear into the ground and hugs his long-lost cousin G, telling him, you go kill other Greeks and I'll kill other Trojans. But between you and me, there's perfect peace. And this in turn so enthuses G that in a spasm of witless bonhomie, he swaps armor with his new friend. Gold armor for bronze, as moronic as trading a Maserati for a Civic, Zeus having short-circuited his thinking. It must have been fun writing that, or however it happened. Okay, this is called The Keep. Jack and Jill went up the hill to the windy keep of Troy. This was long before apnea set in and all our woe. The keep is where you keep things, things of value, cataloged carefully, no matter whose they used to be, which eventually makes for provenance problems up and down the hill, big ones, little itches dogging you into every enclave, nagging like a summer cold when you're not young, when someone's got what's yours, has it, up on the windy keep, up whatever, the thought roots and won't be budged. That certain someone is getting decimated, him and all his glittering connections.
Can I read some new ones?
No, sorry. Well, I might read one. Folk wisdom. The mind, they say, is like a clit or supernatural fingertip, a sensitivity far beyond the spurious permanence of names. And the best thing, or at least the best thing so far, is that this unavoidable sensitivity leaves everything up in the air for the newcomers, the not yet speaking, the infants. Aphrodite and Helen. It's private what we're talking about, but everybody sees it. The dictionary meaning of the next word is aroused, but don't you think in context angry makes better sense? Instantly, Helen knew the goddess's neck, her whole being, through the disguise of the old woman, faithful wool carder, the one she loved most back in Sparta. But this was someone quite different, and Helen cut through the disguise, raising her voice to Aphrodite. Listen, I tell you, it enrages me. Each time you get total access to everything I ever felt, you dandle that thin chain hanging from nowhere all the way down to nursing, and then you get to shove me back into the fucking bedroom. And there's the airhead lover fondling his armor, always the same grin each time he sees me. Okay. Bigger than big. Zeus savors the smoke of perfectly spiced barbecue. And when the really nice wine spills on the proper surface, that's also a thing he greatly enjoys. He's way up there, but the scent arrives, full-bodied. Like they say, just because you're already on high, no reason not to get a little high. Sensory bliss. Snorted. And this is Zeus and Hera at home. And I guess I will say beforehand, this is a fast-paced retelling of a whole long part in the Iliad where Hera, who's on one side, is mad at Zeus, who is temporarily on another side. So she seduces him to get him away from the battlefield. Zeus and Hera at home. At this point, Hera thought just how to get what she wanted. She'd aim all his pleasure right back at the father, brother, husband. She'd knock him off his vantage. His wishes were hateful to her. She'd wreck his plan. So she armored up with oils and other irresistibles. She'd already got hold of the love bead and went up the mountain and presented herself like some ingenue, first time in town, micro fidgeting. Hyper-compliant. As for him, never had he felt so alive, so on top of his game. Not when he played badminton with Daphne, solitaire with Lydia, catch the drift with Sue, let's make a deal with Ray, post office with Dawn, rolled that perfect game with Sally. This was like the first time Even better, it was right before the first time, which was finally going to happen. The cues worked to perfection. The ground literally grew flowers beneath them, the atmosphere candied into a golden fog, so no one outside could really see all that much of anything. Sleep crept out of the branches. Victory was hers, candy from a baby. Then afterwards, when things are a mess, his entire schedule's shot, the beeper won't shut up. That's precisely when she gets to tell him, "Look, it was just sex. I swear on our marriage bed, don't start." The young know all this. They've been hearing it since forever. But they also know that if you've missed the latest, nothing you know is worth much. And that's why it's almost physically impossible. And that's why screens are sacred, and why it's almost physically impossible to look away. Miss something, you're screwed. Okay, I'm going to read this. This is two poems with the same name. The thing about rhymes. The thing about rhymes is they always repeat. It's always up the hill and always tumbling after and always the same stopping place. But stopping places only last so long. And like the immortal gods, once nursery talk loses contact with the living streams of human rememoration, once that varnish gets on you, it's curtains. The thing about rhymes is that they keep happening the same way, so you can see up turned down, and you know that you can set it up again and follow it down again and say again the second it's over to start it back up again, because the change is going to happen this time too. There's some grandparent lore scattered throughout here, and one of my granddaughter was, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about her at two and the tremendous enthusiasm of her. Again, she would say over and over again some little ditty or, you know, page on a Beatrix Potter book or something. Okay. I wasn't going to read this, but I will read this. All right. Wait, if I can find it. I have to look up the table of contents. Hang on. Sorry. Oh, yeah, it's way back. Okay. Okay. All-purpose disaster poem. It's your fucking fault that it's like this. Hand me the remote, would you? Do you need another? I'm having one. It wasn't ever like this. And now it's always like this, and it's your fucking fault. Before, nobody imagined anything like this, but now nobody can think of anything else. And it's your, let's just leave it. But we can't just leave it, and that's your fucking fault. Not that I'm blaming you. There was nothing you could do, really. The friend of my enemy's BFF, who just happens to be the boss's lapdog, and one fine day some drone just happens to blow him to shreds, and there's really nothing anyone could have done or not have done, so who's to know? And that it's that random is your fucking fault. Hand me the remote, would you? When did the guy say he'd be here? 2 hours ago, right? And he's bringing, what? Coors? Coors Light? Honestly, fuck you. I would never. You're saying I ordered Coors Light. You can't be serious. Give me the remote. Mad Men's on. Remember when they tried to cancel the 60s? They're always trying to cancel the 60s. The 60s are dead, deader than psychedelic rock. And whose fault is that? Whose fault is it that nature pisses off my white identified neighbor? Think, because it didn't just happen that it'll never snow enough to cool down my being pissed off. And that's your fucking fault. Of course I walked around in my red corduroy bell bottoms, wherever I wanted to go. And I'm sure you walked around wherever you wanted to go in your red corduroy bell bottoms. You're missing the point. The point is, oh no, I skipped some. I messed up my joke. There's three red corduroy. Of course I walked around in my red corduroy bell bottoms wherever I wanted to go. And I'm sure you walked around wherever you wanted to go in your red corduroy bell bottoms. Why not? It wasn't as if there weren't enough red corduroy bell bottoms to go around. You're missing the point. The point is, we lost the 60s and all the revolutionary potential, and the specific point is, it's your fucking fault. It could have been anyone, which goes without saying. Population is a fact of life. Evolution is a fact, a great number of facts. There are more people than either of us has time for. Fact. Outer space exists. Fact. Fish are disappearing and the seas are rising. Not quite on cue, but we all get the idea. Giant parking lots destroy manners. It's not really a question. Patriarchy sucks the pleasures out of life at an unreplenishable rate. We agree. Every drop goes without saying. Sue me for breathing. Or let's just shut up and wait for our fucking Coors Light. But can we agree? Can we at least agree that it didn't have to happen? But it did. It could have been anyone, but it was you. Where's the remote? Okay. Let's see. I'm going to leave just a couple more things. Okay, here's two little ones. One tiny one. Loveliness of the self in time. Grow grass. Hip hooray. Like that. Dry paint. It's really happening. All over. This one is fourth time's the charm. Can't you see the world is burning? The dream asks. Ha ha, there is no light in dreams. Then doesn't the taste of the charred intelligence of the entire species coat your tongue, offending everything it starts to say or wants to taste? The dream asks. Ha ha, you don't taste in dreams. But the mourners wailing and yelling, the dream laps at the sleeper's ear. Don't these work through your mind's strongest walls? Ha ha, in dreams the ear is so warm and shut. But aren't you at least a little bit scared, a little terrified that some of these things, or newer, worse things, will happen to you and everyone you know? The dream insinuates. And I couldn't agree more, says the sleeper. Look how tight I'm squeezing my pillow. Okay. I'm getting some.
I'm agitating for some of his recent stuff.
Okay, here's a new one if I can find it. Sorry, I'm looking on my. this is I'm writing a poem a day just to sort of keep myself busy. So I'm going to read this. This is not in the book. No title. This was April 18th. Thank you for staying. Can you see me, or am I blocked off because I have my text up? Can you see me here?
Hi, we can see you great.
Okay, because I can't see myself. I just see this text I'm going to read. Okay, April 18th. Thank you for staying open. Eucalyptus, gray-brown in the heavy fog, still here after all the human signs, marks, and thoughts, and all those thoughts thought to do and did, bits of it, adding and crumbling, suing, shoving, positing, driving in the piles with such half-assed outcomes, but so much worse than half-assed. Half-assed would be a dream of serendipitous bliss compared to the vitiating stupidity and vituperative nastiness of contemporary arrangements. Half-assed sounds like heaven. Dear half-assed past, remember that summer we went back to the land fully half-assed in our assumptions? Didn't we grind that sack of wheat berries, warm bread, hot kitchen? I'd choose half-assed in a second. So it's great you're still open. I owe you one, more than gets to be said. But I'll stop with this appropriate distance. Okay, that's one of the new ones. And then let's see if I can find the other one that I wanted to. I thought about it. I wasn't planning to do this. Let's see here. This is a silly one, but I'll read it anyway.
Okay, this is called TMI, toujours TMI. Hey, look, it's a haystack made entirely of needles, when what we really want here is something to eat. Okay, and then I'll just read one more, and then I'll stop. That'll be 20 minutes. A true story. If only we knew what we're talking about, then actions wouldn't have to speak so much louder than words, and what a pleasant state that is going to be. In the meantime, the name tag on the tree says Homo sapiens sapiens, and therefore it gets sawed up and nailed back together, which happens over and over. But inside this one box, guess what? A stash of fuck you very much t-shirts, nearly mint. All right, thanks.